Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the founder of the Audio Builders Workshop, Owen Curtin. First of all, I just found out something that's really interesting. There's another royalty source for backup musicians. Yes, if you're a non-featured performer, you actually have the ability to make some royalties. Now, this is aside from SoundExchange. SoundExchange actually takes 5% of the income from Pandora and from internet radio and from satellite radio and gives that to featured performers who had played on the songs, for instance, to a featured vocalist that might be singing on an EDM song or for a featured soloist. So those royalties have come from SoundExchange for a while, but there has been another royalty that's actually called the Intellectual Property Rights Distribution Fund. And it gave out $60 million last year alone for non-featured performers. So in other words, if you played on a song and it gets streamed on a digital platform, then you might get a royalty. It might not be much, but you'll get a royalty. Now, this is a joint fund in conjunction with the AFM, the Musicians Union, and SAG-AFTRA. SAG-AFTRA is the union for television performers and film performers. So you have to be a member of one of these in order to receive money. But you now can actually get some money from being just a session musician, besides the fee you get for playing. They're also extending this to symphonic musicians and for audiovisual collections for television shows and films, and not only on a domestic basis in the U.S., but also internationally as well. So this is really, really good news. It was actually established back in 1998 with the anticipation that performers were going to be paid for radio airplay. And of course, this never happened, and it's still an ongoing debate in Congress whether this is going to happen or not. The forces of the NAB are pushing very, very hard on it, but I think sooner or later it will happen. That being said, the digital exchange of money came about in 2012 or so, where this fund began to collect from digital platforms. So this is very cool. If you're a backup musician, there's now a new source of income. It's not very much, but it's something, and hopefully it will turn into something a lot better in the future. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Mixing Primer webinar course. Go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. Also check out my new Hitmakers Club for access to all my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to hitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Now, if you own a wireless system of any kind, you better go check it because there are big changes coming up. The wireless band is shrinking. The FCC has auctioned off parts of the UHF spectrum, and they're giving that to mobile for additional mobile bandwidth. Now, this is in the 600 megahertz spectrum. There's a 39-month transition period that just started, and it ends April 30th, 2018. If you happen to have a piece of wireless audio gear, like a microphone, that's transmitting in this particular area, you're going to have to get rid of it or you're breaking the law. Weird, I know. But that being said, the manufacturers are all pretty hip to this, and they're offering rebates to upgrade to something that will work in a higher spectrum. That being said, there's a very, very narrow spectrum between 653 and 664 megahertz that will still be good for wireless, but it will have some restrictions. You're a whole lot better off if you have a piece of wireless gear in the 600 megahertz range, if you just trade it in, upgrade it, and get something else. So it's your responsibility not to interfere with another network, and if you're caught doing it, you're breaking the law, and the FCC will come down on you, and that's why it's a really good idea to go check your wireless gear right now and make sure that whatever it is you have is not in that 600 megahertz spectrum so you don't break the law. My guest today is engineer Owen Curtin, who besides running a commercial studio in Boston, also teaches at various colleges in the area. Owen is also the founder of the very unique Audio Builders Workshops, where engineers who share the do-it-yourself ethic can hear what makes audio products and software tick from the experts who build it. We spoke via Skype from a studio in Massachusetts. I want to get into the Audio Builders Workshop in a bit, but let's start with your background. How did the bridge come about and New England Institute of Art and all of that? Just give me your history here.
Sure. I was a student at Emerson College, and that's actually where I've been doing teaching, you know, the longest. Once I graduated from there, I actually became staff, and then soon after, became a professor there for, well, I guess, about 15 years. So, and I met my current business partner there. He was a student of mine, and he had been doing some work at my freelancing at my small studio. And then eventually we teamed up and opened The Bridge. That was 2008 we got started. We opened the doors officially, I guess, in 2009. Somewhere in there, I started teaching at the New England Institute of Art full-time. I was there for about 12 years. It's an incredible town. And I know you know Boston pretty well, Bobby, but we've got a lot of music and engineering programs. Obviously, MP&E at Berkeley is a huge program, but New England Institute of Art had a pretty substantial program. Emerson, Bay State, UMass Lowell, University of Massachusetts Lowell is a great program. A million other small programs. It's a pretty great town for audio education.
Well, tell me how you get into the do-it-yourself movement here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know. At some point when I had the project studio, I was starting just to get curious about all the stuff that's being, that you can build. There's, at the time, there was just sort of forums, people talking about what could be built and kits for sale in the magazines. You know, you go to the back of Tape Op and you could see the Seventh Circle Audio stuff. And that's actually where I started, about the chassis. Seventh Circle Audio it holds 8 preamps, and I think he's got about 5 different models of preamps available. Some Neve clones and API clones, Millennia clones. I bought a couple of the API kits and the chassis, and then realized I was way over my head. I mean, I didn't know how to solder. I didn't know how to do anything. So I went down. We've got a place called You Do It Electronics, affectionately known as You Blew It around here, where you can you run down there and get that part you forgot to order, or you broke something and you need to get it fixed that day. So I went down there and I bought a little metronome kit, and I forget who makes these little kits. They're about $5. I built a little metronome. It took me all day. I mean, really, Bobby, I didn't know. You know, it says grab the transistor.
Okay. Yeah, all right. What is that?
Yeah, no clue. And so anyway, trying to follow instructions took me all day. But it worked, and I was happy about that. So I started writing on the Seventh Circle stuff until I filled that chassis up. And that was incredible, because it gave me a chance to really start to understand how stuff worked and, you know, how these things are really put together. You know, you can interchange parts, you know, you buy this transformer or this op amp and stuff that I hadn't been familiar with before. But getting a chance to actually do it and read about it and meet friends who were doing it. There's a guy, it was called Eyes and Audio at the time. And he makes a kit, or made a kit, that you could put any op amp in, any transformer. It was for 500 series. That's now, they make that at Hairball now. It's basically the same kit, same group of guys. I think he licensed it. But anyway, that's an amazing kit. And it really sort of changed my life, because my real interest in this, because I could start with just a blank circuit board and start just building whatever preamp I wanted and, you know, listening to that. And so from there, I started to really get some confidence. I couldn't really believe that I had, you know, just looked at a shopping cart, gone to DigiKey and Mauser and just picked out all the parts myself and started making, you know, it wasn't really my design. There were some cookbooks online. I just sort of cobbled together what would work. There had been a revision 1 of this board, and the first cookbook was out. And when the revision 2 of the board came out, the cookbooks hadn't been out. So I really had to make it up a little bit, but it wasn't that hard. And that's when I decided I would build my own product just for myself. I wanted to build a monitor control for 500 series. I had a 40 channel Atari Status console at the time. Great desk, you know, dynamics on every channel, and, you know, just a nice desk, but way more than I needed. I had a little project studio, this huge desk, and I'm using Pro Tools HD. So anyway, I thought, well, if I just get a monitor controller, I'll be all set. I was like, why don't I build one? And so that's when I realized, oh, you can actually make a circuit board online But at the time, you sort of needed a PC to run the software, and I was running a old G4. I couldn't even get Windows or Parallels or anything running.
Yeah.
It was, didn't have the money for a new machine. But I did eventually figure out I could get Eagle, which is a circuit board PCB authoring software, if you want to call it that. You can lay out the schematic and whip up a bill of materials and layout on the actual circuit boards and get them made. So I ended up making a 3-unit 500 series monitor controller. It had VU meters and the amount of dim you'd pick when you hit the talkback. It had an input for talkback mic or a talkback mic mounted on the front. And I learned a ton about just how it is that products are actually made and how they work. One of the secrets there actually blew my mind was that the chips all have data sheets with, if you search up some chip by by that or Texas Instruments, there's going to be a 3 or 4 page document telling you exactly where to put it on the board and how to lay the parts out and how to make it work. I had some great friends, help me with, some of the math and figure out where to put the filters for power filtering and things like that. But it really wasn't super complicated, and I was really excited. And that's sort of become one of the stories I like to tell to people, like, hey, this is accessible to you. We all buy this incredibly expensive gear, and it's not beyond your reach.
Well, it's funny because when I first started in the 60s, we had the same thing. We had Ico and Heathkit, and there was one or two others I can't think of right now, and they've all gone out of business. But so many of my contemporaries learned the same way, just by building a multimeter or, something really simple first, and then from there you kind of go on. And it was the same thing. You used to be able to go in and buy a tube cookbook put out by RCA and all the tubes that would give you all the circuitry. I mean, if you wanted to sit down and design it, you could, you just put modules together basically, and it's the same thing today. But what was interesting was there came a point in time where there were no kits available. There was no do-it-yourself at all. Talking to manufacturers, and there's one in particular that started as Mojave Microphones. They started, first of all, doing kits.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember the article in Tape Op, and it was mind blowing.
And stopped because of the liability. There is a liability concern, and that drove a lot of companies out of the business. What seemed like was a great idea, just because somebody might zap themselves or even burn themselves with the soldering iron, that was too much for a lot of companies. And I'm wondering, and you know a lot of background on this, so how do companies get around that today?
Well, I think one of the biggest changing points, that back in, there was this empty period. And the Mojave mic came out, but I believe it was it came with, you could buy the power supply without building the power supply. Same with the Seventh Circle. You could build the power supply, but you could buy it. I think most of your risks are sort of in the power supply area. The 500 series, sort of the reemergence of the 500 series and people getting into that, I think really sort of opened the door to people, because that has a built-in power supply and you're just dealing with the low voltage stuff when you're building. I think another thing that sort of sparked my re-interest, inspired me to get back involved in this was there's a guy named Peterson Goodwin who has a company called DIYRE, DIY Recording, recording equipment. And what he did is he took all that stuff from the forums and all these individual kits. Like, everybody's been building these G-series compressors for as long as I can remember. And you buy the circuit board here and the chassis there and the power supply over here and the mod kits over there. And it was just sort of hard to figure it out. You had to really go through the forums and get to be friendly with people and they explain it to you. But Peterson took all this information, all these kits, and put them on a wiki page at his website. And for me, that was just like, oh my gosh, everyone's in now. Like, the door's open. People are going to get involved now. And, and I think that's sort of where, I don't really know why more people are involved in the kit making, but, I guess SSL now has a PCB for 500 series that you can play with, but mostly it's small manufacturers, it's small guys, Cappy and, all these other just smaller outfits. And I don't know how they're getting away with the liability concerns. But I think mostly it's the power supply. It was actually in meeting Peterson and seeing that he took his information and made a wiki that really got this Audio Builders Workshop started. I called Peterson and I said, hey, I want to meet you. I'm, thank you for doing this. I think that people up here in Boston would like to meet you, and a lot of us are into sort of do it yourself thing. You know, why don't you come up and I'll make sure that some people come and meet you. It turned out to be a packed house. We did it at the Bridge Sound and Stage, which is my recording studio. And we had, I put up 40 or 60 chairs, and it was a full house. Everyone wanted to hear what he was saying. We got a whole bunch of other people there that day as well to talk.
When was this?
This is about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay.
Builder's Workshop started like that, just as a sort of on a whim. I said, let's try this. And at the end of the workshop, everyone said, hey, that was fun. When are you doing it again? and it was a sort of a reasonable question. I've been teaching in the town forever. People sort of know that I like to do, like to hold events at the studio, but I honestly hadn't considered it. You know, at the time I knew that the New England Institute of Art was closing. This was my full-time job. And I thought, well, I've built a product. I know how to do that. At least I know how to prototype a product. I have no idea how to get something like that to market. And maybe in a couple of years, I'll want to do that. That's what I'll do when the school closes. So the first workshop was called From Prototype to Production. Neil Miller is a friend of mine. He was there. He worked on the Parker Fly guitar, that graphite guitar. Yeah. Yeah, great guitar. He'd done the circuit board design for that. And Michael Blackmere came. So son of David Blackmere, and worked at Electric Lady and involved at Earthworks and just tons of product development stuff. Great guy. I'm just trying to think of my friend Tony Norton, who
there's a rich history in Boston of electronics manufacturers, especially audio manufacturers. So yeah.
Right. And as this thing has grown, it's just a quick phone call for me to call somebody who's just a powerhouse in manufacturing and production. I mean, the speaker we're doing the upcoming one on the 29th of this month is about acoustics and speaker design and control room design. And to find speaker manufacturers and acoustics guys, it's nothing in this town. We've just got so many. We're actually going to be hosted by Ascentec. They're a huge firm that does architectural acoustic design. I'm really lucky like that.
Wow. Yeah, that's very cool. Is this your second one that you're doing?
Oh, no. I pulled it up here so I could remember all the ones we've done. I guess it's been about every 3 months.
Oh, that's fast. Wow. And do each of them have a different theme?
Yeah, that's right. The first one was from prototype to product. And then we built some products. We built a DI and a distortion pedal. Mm. But then we did one all about microphone preamps. We had Dave Thibodeau, he works at with Jeff Daking at the Daking.
Yeah.
And we had some guys from Coleman Rogers from Analog Craftsman, Analog Devices.
Yeah.
And we had these two guys, the Gaskell brothers, who were just incredible. They came down from McGill. And we just talked about how mic preamps work and, what's the difference between a discrete op amp and these chip-based designs. And actually, the Gaskell brothers make a kit that the circuit board is laid out sort of like a block diagram. So as you're putting it together, you really are learning how the parts interact. It's for a class that they teach up at McGill, and so it's an educational tool. We built that two-channel preamp the next day. People just learned a ton from that. The one we did most recently was about digital signal processing, and iZotope, they're here in Cambridge, right up the street from the studio. They hosted us. They have a beautiful space there. A bunch of guys come in and talk about how plugins are made. This isn't like it's not a hands-on electronics building, but Audio Builders Workshop is just growing a little more larger than just that electronics beginning. People say, what is it? I don't know what it is. It's not like it's some big for-profit company. It's not about that at all. It's really about me saying, well, I've got some friends who have some information. Why don't I invite them by and, make a day of it. And whatever it is, the spirit of this group of friends that I have is just people who want to build something to do with recording and to do with music. So that's for this next one. I think most of us have small studios at home. And a lot of us have big studios, and we're just trying to decide, what do we hire out for? What is it we paid for in these control room designs? Can we understand it a little better? And then can we bring some of that home and improve the sound of our room or the sound of our speakers? So that's the one coming up.
I just had Paul Wolf on the podcast. As a matter of fact, it's up now. And of course, he owned API for 20 some years and then Tone Lux and has just done stuff for Slate and for A Designs and on and on and on. And this is a really knowledgeable guy. He's a legend in audio design. And he went through some of the reasons why different consoles sound different,
and
the real basics of all this. And he and I thought he knew this stuff, but he explained it in a way I went, wow, that's cool. Okay, I didn't know that. You know, so you might want to take a listen, because it's very cool. He just lays this stuff out in a way that's very understandable. And there's some mystique, you know, when it comes to the sound of certain devices, certain brands. And he kind of laid it bare, which is kind of cool.
Right. Yeah, I was really blown away with these Gaskell brothers. They were talking about, you know, how we went from the discrete op amps, you know, like the 2520, to these chip-based things. And, you know, what was the difference? What were the limitations? You know, okay, everything's been miniaturized. A resistor is a resistor at some point. They're just cutting it into silicone rather than making me put it as a through-hole part or even a surface mount part. It's just part of this chip. They've got these teeny little parts in there. I said, well, what are the differences? Oh, okay, well, they can't fit the capacitor. They just can't miniaturize that. Well, where does it fit? How do you get that component near this chip so it works in the right way? How do you integrate the different parts together? And so it was just amazing. They took the discrete op amps and the chip and actually showed us, this is how you make the actual chip. It's very similar to the original op amp, but these are the limitations. This is as small as you can actually make something. It was very informative. The two of them did three talks in total that day, each an hour long, you know, PowerPoint presentations. You know,
are you recording these?
I am. Actually, we've got those. We've recorded all the footage from all the workshops, and we've also been bringing in guests and filming them here at my new job, where we have a nice TV studio, and we're collecting a lot of footage. We've got a vault. We've got, you know, how vinyl is made, some basic electronics classes, some general audio knowledge. At this point, we're just collecting footage, and we're going to be putting it out. I don't know when. Don't make me commit. Yeah. But we're working on it. We're working on it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, this is stuff that I think people that are into audio really want to know. I mean, if you're passionate about it, you want to know the nuts and bolts. I know there's a whole, especially some of the classic engineers, where they don't know anything about electronics, don't care, and they're still great. And there are those people, but I think most people that are passionate in our business really want to know as much as they can about the nuts and bolts of everything.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, there's a lot of guys who they just want to know how their guitar works. They just want to play their guitar or their keyboard, and they're musicians, and then they've learned to engineer, and then they get sucked into the electronics.
Yeah, happened to me.
And yeah, that's right. It's fascinating. And then there's guys who come at it from a technical side, and they've already started there. But you know, as we look at our heroes, we're like, you know, who is Rupert Neve? Who was Bill Putnam? And we think, oh, these guys were building all this gear. Maybe I can do it.
Yeah.
And you know, and in this town where we've got MIT and all these incredible colleges around here. And the other thing that's unique about Boston, I think, is that, you know, it's not LA. You lived here long enough to know that we've got a really powerful, strong music scene, but most guys have a day job, and the day jobs around here are, they're in high tech, they're in education. So when we bring in these guys who are, you know, this group of the audio builders, they tend to be, you know, pretty well versed in engineering and pretty well versed in music. They have a diverse lifestyle. So it's been a pretty amazing that, you know, the guys who come to these things, we get from all walks of life. You know, even some of these guys who are into hi-fi, that's a whole another area of what we do, this you know, hi-fi consumer end of listening to music, you know, hi-fi speakers, hi-fi power amplifiers. And even that crew is starting to hang out a little bit at the builders workshops, which is cool.
Yeah. Well, okay, you have your finger on the pulse of this. So what are the trends that are happening in do-it-yourself?
Well, it's been growing really steady. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing. We keep getting more and more products. I would say, you know, it started with this, well, obviously the kits, like the G-Series compressors, and then the 500 series stuff. I mean, that's just blown up. I think the microphone stuff, you know, we all obviously had this huge influx of microphones from China, essentially, and all over the East Asia. But I think now the kits for microphones, that's pretty awesome. I can't remember if you interviewed Mike yet from Microphone Parts.
I have not.
No, I don't know. No. He's, you know, he's got all the different bodies and all the capsules. You can sort of put together any mic. I mean, when I built his microphone, what did I get? I got a 251, and, you know, get the thing built, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, it sounded great. But I was like, you know, I have a bunch of, what was I thinking? I have a bunch of mics that kind of sound like 251s. So, you know, I said to my buddy Derek, I said, hey, you just built that mic with a 47 capsule. Can we swap capsules? It was just an awesome experience to just reach in and actually swap a capsule. First of all, these things are like, you know, don't touch them. You're sort of nervous around this stuff, but the price point comes so down now. It's so low. I mean, it's just big deal if you happen to goof it up, but we didn't. And we swapped the capsules. And oh, this is actually a mic that I don't have a, you know, a tube mic with a 47 capsule in it, which seems ridiculous. And this sounds great. I'm so happy I have that mic now. And just was a fun project. We had one of these Elmo projectors. They use them in schools to take a sort of like a microscope that puts up, that projects onto the wall. It's like a microscope projector. So we put the capsules under there, and we had some junkers, and we took them apart and got to, you know, look at the mylar and where moisture had gotten on it.
That's
It was just
awesome.
really,
Yeah.
yeah, really fun.
That's very cool.
Really fun.
Now, of course, I'm lucky because in my neighborhood here, I can go see David Bach from Bach Audio and his workshop, and Royer's up the street and whatever, and just see, you know, how they're doing things. So I've watched all that. But it's different when you're in a manufacturing environment to see how they're doing things. It's very cool, but it's cooler what you're doing when you can pull stuff apart and mix and match, and there's no thought of brand as much as, well, let's just make something that works and works really well.
That's exactly right. Yeah, just find your sound and get a chance to play. Yeah, I mean, we've got Telefunken just down the street there in Connecticut, but that's
Yeah,
not
so
whatever, an
right.
hour south of Mira. And yeah, they've done that themselves. They've taken some classic designs. They've obviously remade a lot of the old mics, but they've made their own mics and their own sound. And it's that same idea, like, oh yeah, we're doing what Telefunken does, but you know, we're buying the parts and we might goof it up, but so
Right.
far so good. So far so good. Yeah. Microphone parts has a new kit. I guess I saw him at AES in LA, so I think it was out in October. But he's got a new kit that's just a electric cap. It's a really easy to put together. I think sounds great. So he sees this idea. Okay, well, these high end guys like me and you and I might not mind spending 600, 700, $800 on a mic that we might break, but probably going to put together and work great. But what about these younger students who want to do it? I think he's in it. You know, I shouldn't quote somebody else's price, but it's around $200, and you really can't goof it up. It's really easy to build, and you get a great sounding mic. So yeah, I mean, you asked about trends. I really do think that that's something newer is the idea that more people are building microphones, for sure. Oh, and you know, the swapping out the op amps. Sort of mixed opinions on that, but that you definitely get some, you know, there's definitely different sounds from different op amps, and so you can get the I guess Lindell or maybe Stam, or I'm just trying to think of some of these companies that when they sell you a product, it's socketed. So sockets are just a place so you don't actually solder the op amp, and you just pull the op amp right out and stick another one in, which is great if you blow one up. You can blow up an op amp, you know, just trying to seat it in your 500 series, if you're silly enough to try to hot swap a 500 series unit.
Okay, what do you see as the best value? Is there something out there that you just look at and go, wow, everybody should have this?
Well, I think it comes down to who the user is. You know, in my project studio at home, I'll use anything. And if it breaks, it's not mission critical. If I don't put it together right, it's not mission critical. In that case, I can't think of anything you wouldn't build, because you can take a day. Just, oh, I goofed that up. It didn't work. Okay, equipment breaks all the time. My expensive equipment breaks all the time. It's getting used, you know, whatever that is, 16 hours a day, and something's gonna happen. But when you build it yourself, and I'm not the greatest builder in the world, I'm a good teacher, a good organizer of stuff, but I don't have the incredible fine motor skills that some of these friends of mine who build stuff. When my gear breaks, I'm thinking, it's probably my fault, and that's been a sort of a dilemma. Oddly enough, I get great resale value out of all the stuff I built. You know, people are interested in it. And I'm able to sell it, and most, you know, most of the market out on eBay and Reverb and wherever else you're selling stuff. Here in Boston, we've got a great group. Most of the engineers are on a Facebook group together, and a private group for most of the studio owners, and it's really nice to be able to exchange gear that way. But yeah, the DIY stuff maintains its value. I don't know if I think that one thing is more incredible than the next, but that the line between what you're going to have and you need it to be mission critical, and you want to blame someone else when it breaks, and you don't want to blame your own builder, you know?
Yeah.
That's the sort of the key thing to it. But I mean, none of it is not as good. It's the clone. They're clones, but it's the same as the original. If you build the right clone, if you build a nice clone of something, you're going to save a lot of money. A tremendous amount of money.
You know, I was mentioning Paul Wolf before. He's the father, the creator of the 500 series.
Right.
And I asked him, so how did that come about? And you might want to listen to that podcast because, you know, it's a good story. He's a very incredible guy. Considering how the 500 series has taken off right now, everybody has something in 500 series. Every studio, every engineer, you know, every project studio, mostly, you know, there's some sort of 500 series. The price to value ratio is so high on it that hard to say no.
You know, rack space, you know, in 3U, 19-inch units, I got 8 or 11, depending on the chassis I'm using. That's 11 processors in what used to hold 3 or maybe 6 if you count stereo units. Like, yeah, that's a lot. You know, sometimes you might get an 8-channel pre, right? But
yeah,
I'm getting an 11-channel chassis now for 500 series. So my studio, the professional studio, when you walk in, the idea isn't for the client to see any gear. We all know they don't care what we buy.
Yeah, right.
That's our problem.
Right.
That's our addiction. You know, they see a piano, you know, a keyboard controller, and all that gear is below waist level in the underneath the producer's desk and in our desk, and we can get so many channels in 500 series. I think we've got 211 space and 1/8 space chassis at the moment. That's a lot of 500 series. Wouldn't track without it. We ended up getting, I had that Otari in the space. It's been 3 years now. I mean, I know you're comfortable with a mouse and a keyboard. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, sort of how we mix. And we looked at putting a control surface in, but we sort of thought, how often do we need the control surface versus how often are we using the keyboard? How much, you know, the music creation goes on in this room. That's what we do. We get a 2,000 square foot space. We track full bands, you know, big bands, and we didn't really need the control surface or the console anymore. We had it all in outboard gear.
Yeah.
500 series. 500 series is what changed the game on that. That's why I wanted a monitor controller for it. And it's great.
Okay. So when is the next Audio Builders Workshop?
So it's on the 29th at Ascentec here in Cambridge. And we've got some pretty great people. Let's try to open that up so I can give myself some notes. A friend of mine, Jay Frigoletto, he's another teacher, and he's going to be talking about the history of control rooms. You know, I've got this guy, Louis Athanas. He's got 5 patents. He does this audio glass technology. It's a shake. You can use glass like a speaker. But he's got like over 30 products on the market right now, or in the market in his life that he's put out to production, mostly in the hi-fi speaker world. I mean, mm-hmm. Boston's a huge town for that.
Sure.
We got a guy coming in he's been commissioned to do art at Burning Man. He's a sculptor, but he also builds cabinets for one of the large soffit mounted cabinet speaker monitors for mains. So he's going to talk about the carpentry involved in building cabinets.
Oh, cool. That's great. Well, how much is it?
So it's $59 to get in. That's all day. It's 9 to 5. Actually, this one's going to go till 6, includes lunch.
Good
basically
price.
What you're paying for there. Yeah. I mean, what you're paying for there is for me to take everyone out to dinner, not all the guests, but all the hosts. And we've got 10 hosts, and I bring them all out to dinner afterwards, just as a way of saying thank you. And that's all it costs. You know, I have a day job. I've got a recording studio. Those are what I do to, you know, pay the bills. But this Builder's Workshop, it's just sort of what I'm doing, because I want to learn more about this stuff. So that, yeah, I tell people if cost is an issue, and you can't, you just reach out to me. And if you can't find me, then you don't know how to use the internet. So just reach out and you get in. I always give discounts for the Audio Engineering Society. Boston's got a great, really strong AES chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, they're local as the current president and outgoing president are both from our area, and the local chapter's really strong. So I always give them a coupon in any of the student groups, anybody who asks.
Sure, sure. Okay. Yeah. Last question, sort of off the subject. I ask everybody the same question. What's the best piece of business advice that either you learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
I wouldn't be the person, first of all, to give anybody business advice.
Yes, but who gave it to you?
Well, I would say, I look at basically both of my parents would be the strongest influences in giving me any business advice. And what I've seen in what they do and what I've had success in is just pursuing my passions. When I get off track, when I'm just too bogged down and actually doing the job, life gets a little dull. And when I'm interested, like currently really interested in building, if I pursue that, good things have happened. And that's the thing, it's just to follow your passions. I say I'm not the one to take business advice. I've got a recording studio in not in LA and not in Nashville and not in New York, in a really great town, but not a town known for, making your fortune in music. Although we certainly had our fair share. But I've never really struggled finding work. I've never had an issue with that. And I find that anytime it's not my education, it's not my master's degree, it's not the time I spent sitting behind the console because it was hard. It's the time I spent being really interested and asking questions of why does this work and just loving what I'm doing and asking about it. And that's what's led to my success, And in this industry, if you're not driven by that, what are you doing here?
Yeah, that's right. If you want to find out more about the very cool Audio Builders Workshop, you can go to audiobuildersworkshop.com. That's all one word, audiobuildersworkshop.com. For more about Owen, go to owencurtin.com. That's Owen, Owen, Curtin, Curtin, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being on my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyowinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyowinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyowinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.